This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book, a great book. And I have, I have a couple today that I'm going to be talking about. And it is 2/22/22. Okay, I hope that's a lucky day. Anyway, everybody, we're going to have 87 degrees temperature here. Oh, I'm sorry about that for all of you people up north who are listening to me, particularly my friends up in Maine. I know you're listening. I don't know how you can stand it. Your temperature's about what my freezer is. Anyway, I was going to speak to somebody in England today who, unfortunately, she has COVID and isn't up to talking. No, it's not the Queen. It's not the Queen. But it is somebody really wonderful. And I'm still going to talk about her, and I'm going to play a part of an interview I had with her before. But first, I want to play a book buzz from Rita Moreau, which I didn't get a chance to play the other day. I talked about it, and it is so wonderful. Rita Moreau is doing such a wonderful job with these book buzzes, and she enjoys them so much. And this one is for our friend here at Joy on Paper, Carol J. Perry, my very first guest in the studio, and she started her second series. She's so prolific. Book 12 of her Witch City Mysteries is coming out on April 26th, and she will be here in the studio to talk about that and probably bring a thunderstorm along with her like she usually does. But it's a bright and sunny day, and so it's a good day to talk about her new series, which is set right here in our area of sunny Florida in the St. Petersburg area. It's an imaginary town, but everybody who knows this area will recognize many of the places, and it's called Haven, Florida. So here's a book buzz from Rita Moreau, who, by the way, is going to guest host Joy on Paper on March 29th, when I head off for Texas. And so Rita's going to come here in the studio and handle the whole show for one day. But right now, let's listen to her book buzz.
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with today's book buzz. If you are looking for a mystery that you won't be able to put down, then I have just the book for you.
Be My Ghost, a Haunted Haven Mystery Book 1. Cozy mystery fans, you'll be thrilled with Carol J. Perry's Be My Ghost Book 1 in her new Haunted Haven Mystery series set in Florida. Maureen Daughtry is a smart, forthright protagonist of this exceptional paranormal cozy. As Publishers Weekly notes in their starred review, Maureen is a breath of fresh air in the cozy world. No ruminating on her looks or past tragic loves. No drowning her sorrows in cookies and cake. It all starts on a cold and rainy day in Boston when Maureen's career as a sportswear buyer hits a snag just before Halloween, when the department store declares bankruptcy. The former buyer of the year needs to start job searching, and fast. Salvation comes when she receives a mysterious inheritance. An inn in Haven, Florida, a quaint scenic town on the Gulf of Mexico, hidden away from highways and theme parks. The letter from the lawyer doesn't explain why someone named Penelope Josephine Gray would leave her a century-old Haven House Inn. Should she pick up and head south? Why not? Finn, her golden retriever who flunked guide dog classes because he's too friendly, would probably like to get some fun in the sun. Better than walking the cold and wet streets of Boston in October. Maureen hopes it will be a fresh start. She doesn't know what to expect, but what the heck? It's an adventure. So she packs up her car and, with Finn, riding shotgun, and a box of Kane's donuts between them, she heads south. From the way Finn's wagging his tail, it looks like he approves of the move. The lawyer didn't tell her much, just that over the years, many famous people vacationed in Florida, and many of them stayed at Haven Inn. When she pulls up to the old place, she is enchanted by the rocking chairs on the front porch. But within hours, before she can even unpack her bags, Maureen discovers a prominent ghost hunter's lifeless body on the inn's front porch. What was he doing there? Not the welcome she expected. Worse, soon the police have their eyes on her as a suspect. She has no friends in Florida to help her, but some of the inn's everlasting tenants in the form of ghosts offer their otherworldly talents in order to help her solve the mystery. The ghosts, in a refreshing departure from most paranormal cozies, don't take center stage in entertaining subplots such as her efforts to discover why Miss Gray left her the inn keep the pages turning in this fast-paced cozy. The Haunted Haven series will beguile and bewitch readers, and have them eagerly looking forward to further adventures with Maureen and, of course, her pal Finn. Look forward to more fun and mystery in glorious Haven, Florida.
Okay, thank you, Rita, and thank you very much, Carol J. Perry, for being such a great friend to Joy on Paper. And She's working on her, I think she just met her deadline for the second book in that series. Boy, oh boy, she is one writer who is dedicated. And talking about a dedicated author, I want to talk a little bit about who I was going to hopefully talk to in England. An author who's been on the program before. Many of you have seen the movie of her book, and it is Jojo Moyes. It was very funny. When I first started the program, I had already read her book called Me Before You, which when I read it at the time, I said to myself, oh, this would make a great movie. I just knew it. I could have written the screenplay right then and there. And then lo and behold, a little while later, I start Joy on Paper and the second book comes out. So this was a few months after I had started Joy on Paper, about 5 months, I think, 5 months later, Jojo Moyes called in from England, and we spoke about her second book in the trilogy, and it was Me After You. And there's a third book called Still Me. Now, when I talked to her, it was wonderful to talk to her because she had been 65 weeks on the New York best-selling list. So, yeah, no, she's doing pretty well. And of course, at that time, the movie was just being made. And I think it's available on Prime. And that's the one called Me Before You, a very, very well done movie. And so here is in part of my interview with her, because it was just so much fun to talk to her. So let's go ahead and run that. I was waiting for a special guest, Jojo Moyes, best-selling author, but we've had some technical difficulties. She is on tour today. She is a best-selling author. She was on the best-selling list for 65 weeks. Do we have her? Yay!
Hi!
Okay, a little confusion there, Jojo. It's so nice to talk to you. So this is Jojo Moyes. I was just telling everyone about you. What can I say? You are amazing. There are not many people who have been 65 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
That was pretty amazing, I have to say.
It's like a
dream come true. It was kind of incredible.
It is incredible. And then at a certain point, you had three of your books on the best-selling list.
Yeah, you better stop because I think people are just going to not like me anymore.
No. Well, it's a well-deserved success. I know that you sold at least 5 million of Me Before You, which is a nice title of those. So the new book that's coming out today, so this is an exciting day for you, is called After You. So tell us a little bit about it.
So really, the book picks up 18 months after the end of Me Before You. And it was a book I hadn't planned to write, but something kind of strange happened with Me Before You, which is, unlike the books I wrote before that one, I just had this endless stream of emails and messages from people who wanted to talk about Louisa Clark, the main character. And I don't know if it was because they saw themselves in her or because it reflected something that was going on in their own lives, but it meant that whereas mostly your characters leave you once you finished a book, Louisa never did. And so finally, after kind of a couple of years of responding to these reader emails, I allowed myself to ask the question that they were asking me, which was, well, what would happen to her next? And once I had an answer, I just felt I had to write the book.
Well, you know, if there had been tweets in the old days, Margaret Mitchell might have done a sequel to Gone with the Wind. But in your
what
case,
a thought that is.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
In your case, you know, it's always hard to do a sequel. It's not a easy thing because you have to maintain the integrity of your characters, and you have done that.
That's exactly it. I hope you think so.
Yes.
I thought it was going to be easy. I'm going to admit that. I thought that because I knew the character so well and I had this plot mapped out in my head, I thought, well, this is going to be great because my biggest problem is usually creating the characters. That's the thing that I really put the most work into, just to try and make people who are kind of complex and a bit original and interesting. And what happened was I started writing and then I just kept hearing the voices of readers and feeling this weight of expectation of people sort of saying, oh, no, she wouldn't do that, or I don't like the fact that she did this. And it was quite paralyzing for a while. And in the end, I sat down with a friend of mine who's also a novelist, and she was pretty tough with me, and she just said, you cannot think about what other people think. You just have to write the book that you want to write and, you know, hope that they'll come along with you. But you can't think about what other people are going to think. And she was absolutely right, because as soon as I just went back to being in my bubble, as she put it, then it came a lot more easily.
For any writer, really good writer like you, our characters become so much a part of us that it is hard to put them away. And so it's rather fun that you got to do this.
Oh, do you know, it was the most fun because there's not a lot of characters who I really feel a kind of a huge personal connection to. But I loved writing Louisa. I still love writing her. She was one of those rare things, you know, the character that just kind of drops fully formed into your lap. And I knew who she was from the start. And it means that I can kind of put her in all sorts of situations and know how she will react. And I'm sure you and a lot of your writer listeners will know that that really doesn't always happen. So yeah, I love writing her. I never get tired of it.
Well, one thing I love about your books is that I love how you managed, well, you sort of juxtapose the upper class and lower class as it's thought about in England. Now, in America, of course, we don't have that class thing. So, you know, but I lived in England for quite a few years. I lived in Sonning, you know, near Henley.
Uh-huh.
And so I was aware of the class difference and how, you know, in Lou's case, you know, she's a barmaid. And yet, you know, there's all this other class mixture that you do. And I think I love it. That's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. I mean, as a writer, it's you know, the thing that books really thrive on is tension. And what class does is introduce a whole nother layer of tension into people's relationships. And I think it's only when you leave the UK that you realize how locked into that structure we all are, especially outside London, funny enough. You know, it's kind of made explicit in the countryside by the kinds of houses that people live in. And
it's people don't understand. I explain. I would know people who had made a fortune and they bought beautiful, uh-huh, you know, Georgian homes, and they did everything with the greatest taste, and they, you know, renovated them, and but it didn't matter because always where they were born or what class they were born into was always the defining factor. Unlike in America,
that's
where
so
you can
true.
You know, you can be dirt poor and become, uh-huh, a millionaire, and you can talk about being dirt poor, and you're proud of being dirt poor. Whereas in England, it doesn't quite work that way. It's a matter of a combination of the accent, which you never you know. Mm-hmm. So, and it's fun. I like that that you take just ordinary, you know, a barmaid or a cleaning woman, and make mm-hmm. them the main, you know, figure in the story, because most people aren't upper class, and you know, so it's I think it works very well for you.
Oh, thank you. I agree. I think that possibly, you know, what we would call the working classes get a bit of a raw deal in fiction, because in the UK, if people are including kind of those sorts of jobs and those sorts of scenarios, it usually means that someone's about to get murdered. People don't tend to be massively interested in the lives of people at the bottom. And I am interested because I've kind of done those jobs in the past, and I'm interested in kind of society as a whole and what happens if you are brought up in the belief that, you know, you can be anything and do anything, but in a society which is increasingly kind of structured so that you probably can't. And, you know, I like to sort of look at the way people keep themselves in those prisons as well. I mean, the thing that sort of interested me about Lou in this book was how we can think we learn these life lessons and you want to move on and lead a bigger life and take forward all the things that you've learned. But often we just slide back into old patterns of behavior, and it's really luck and judgment whether you manage to pull yourself back out again.
Well, I think one of the hallmarks of your writing is that you do like to have that sort of tension, not just of classes, but tension of different types of people, you know, and I like that very much. So many people, when like in before you, is a disturbing subject, what you wrote about.
Yeah.
And both from the point of view that the story's about a quadriplegic and it's a love story, and then, of course, the ending. But you've done a brilliant job of making it really a true love story. Many people are talking about how this is going to be a classic of this type of book. It's wonderful.
Thank you. I just found out today that one of the major retailers in the UK has named it one of their 100 classic reads of all time. So I'm kind of feeling a bit overwhelmed by that at the moment. But no, I think what I like is to take an issue that isn't black and white. And I think just because you're looking at an issue like, you know, quadriplegia or assisted suicide doesn't mean that it has to be dressed up in some kind of highfalutin moral language. I think that often if you just tell a simple story using straightforward language, you can actually cover some really complex issues. And the thing about that was it didn't come up with a conclusion. It didn't say, this is the right way, this is the wrong way, this is how you should do it. It just asked you to put yourself in other people's shoes.
Yes, and exactly. It let the reader make the decision within themselves, and I think that was really a very, you know, nice way to do it. You don't make that decision for the reader that this is good, this is bad.
Thank you. That's really what I intended.
Well, I think you know, of course, it's very exciting for you after being on the best-selling list, and then of course getting a movie deal, and
yes,
not just not just any movie
fun.
Deal. I mean, you got Emilia Clarke, right? Is from Game of Thrones,
yep.
and uh-huh. Sam who's playing Will?
Will Sam Claflin? Yeah. He you'll know him from Hunger Games.
That's right.
And from a couple of other films like Love, Rosie. He's just wonderful.
So it must have been exciting to you watch the filming, because you did.
I did.
You wrote the screenplay, right?
And that's right, and it was a real steep learning curve, and I loved every minute. And I think, you know, as a writer, there's a kind of huge privilege in getting to see your people become real. The first day was sort of mind blowing.
Well, that's what I, you know, it's wonderful to see your words on paper, but as a screenwriter myself, it's hearing somebody's speak your words that really it's amazing. It's an amazing feeling. So,
and I think, you know, well, you'll know being a screenwriter, but being on set, you learn that some words work really well and some lines work really well, and others you have to rewrite because they don't play as well off the page as they did once they're in the hands of the actors, and that was kind of part of the really interesting thing as well, learning that, you know, screenwriting, the screenplay does not exist by itself. It comes to life really with the actors and the action going on behind and the speed and the music and the color, and yeah, that was fascinating.
Well, I know the movie's going to come out next year, right?
That's right. I think sort of May, June. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, that's going to be exciting for you to be at the premiere of a movie based on your bestseller. And I am sure that the new book after you is going to be, well, you have already, I think, built in audience of 5 million people. So
I hope you're right.
Well, no, I'm sure, because anyone who has read Me Before You, I think that they are left with that thing, what happens to Lou? And I think it's going to be another bestseller. So I just want to thank you so much for joining me today, because I know it's a very, very busy day for you. You are on a sort of grand tour of America, are you?
That's right. Yeah, this is day two of a 2-week tour of the States.
This is exciting.
Yeah.
And
it is.
So at least you have Skype, so you can see your kids back home and
yes, they I like to show them whichever hotel I'm in. We do that thing FaceTime, which has kind of totally changed the lives of all working parents.
Okay.
I think.
Well, that's great. Well, I'm so happy that I got to speak to you even for a little while on this very, very important day for you, and I wish you all the best of luck. It's going to be a really great bestseller, and so everybody out there, if you haven't read Me Before You, go and get that and then follow it up with Jojo Moyes' brilliant new book, After You.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Jojo. Have a great trip.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Angie, bye.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I just want to remind you that that interview with Jojo Moyes was from September of 2015. Well, you know, it's going to be the 7th anniversary of Joy on Paper, and the time has gone so fast, and at that time, the movie hadn't come out yet. The movie was a blockbuster hit, went over $200 million. It was, and it's still playing, I think, on Prime. And, well, a tremendous hit. And of course, her book, second book, went on to go on the bestseller list. And she's quite an amazing person. So I sent her good wishes this morning that she gets over COVID. And I hope the queen gets over her COVID. And, well, the world is a crazy place. And I do want to mention, I bungled the name. Sam Claflin is the one who starred in the movie. It's just one of those names. It's difficult to remember. It's sort of like the new actor who's playing Jack Reacher. Sometimes if an actor doesn't sound like their name, it's hard to remember. But anyway, it's fun. Now, I want to, while I was sort of being nostalgic about 2015, I happened to look over at my wall of books. I have so many walls of books, but I was looking at them, and one particular book stood out to me. And it was also, because I was looking at the guests for 2015, and this gentleman was also on the program, and his name is Wayne McDowell. And there on my list, my shelf of military books, is his wonderful book, Not Just Another War Story. So I want to play, one of the things I like doing here on Joy on Paper is to remind you of books that you should not miss. And the biggest problem for writers today is they have that short window of opportunity, even for very, very famous authors. They have 2 or 3 weeks to get out there and sell their books. And then after that, they don't get noticed and they don't get talked about until the next book comes out. So it's very difficult for authors to find a place or to anyone to promote their books. But here at Joy on Paper, that's why we do the book buzzes, to remind you of books that you should not miss. And this is a wonderful book. It's called Not Just Another War Story by Wayne McDowell. I want to play the just part of the interview, because I actually gave him the entire hour. I don't normally do that. I have two guests usually in an hour, but I wanted to talk to Wayne about this book because I love the book, and it's about a subject that I know well. As a matter of fact, it was so interesting for me because this is a book about World War II. It's about a pilot of my second favorite airplane, the B-17 Flying Fortress. I love that plane. For any of you who had the opportunity to visit Fantasy of Flight, which is on exit 44 on the way to Orlando, Kermit Weeks has a B-17. Unfortunately, the museum is not open right now. I hope that they get the financing to open it again, because it is a wonderful museum. When you go there, you are really inspired and just you admire what our military did. And Kermit Weeks is a beautiful, beautiful place. As a matter of fact, we were going to shoot the film that I wrote for Debbie Reynolds there, which was called Sunshine Pilot. And we were scheduled to start shooting there at Fantasy of Flight. And Kermit Weeks was actually going to fly some of his airplanes in the film. So it was sort of heartbreaking for everybody, for Debbie Reynolds, for all of us, that we didn't get to make that film. But that happened in 2008 when the world collapsed, and who knows, the world might collapse again. But anyway, that was what happened. But I want to play part of this interview with Wayne McDowell, because it is a book that you should get, and it is also available on Audible. So as a matter of fact, if you start a free trial of Audible, you get the book free. But let's go ahead and play this interview.
And here with a song of the Army Air Corps is Bing Crosby.
Off we go into the wild blue yonder. Keep the wings level and true. If you'd live to be a gray-haired wonder, keep the nose out of the blue.
Hi, Wayne.
Hello, Patsy. It's great to be here, and hello to all your listeners out there as well.
Well, I love pilots. Well, because my husband is a pilot. And of the planes that I love the F-105, which I'm very deeply involved in doing a project about F-105 pilots. The next favorite is the B-17. So tell us about how you came up with the idea.
Sure thing. The dedication is to First Lieutenant Wright Ellis Gerke. And Uncle Wright was a B-17 pilot with the 305th Bomb Group out of Chelveston, England. I had read all of my Uncle Wright's letters. I knew him very well. He was like an older brother to me. In fact, before he went away with his 1936 Oldsmobile, he would let me shift the gears while he was put the clutch in on the car and taught me how to whistle, as a matter of fact. And Uncle Wright joined the Air Force, became a B-17 pilot, flew with the 8th Air Force out of Chelveston, England, and sadly he was killed on the 12th of August of 1943 on a mission to Gelsenkirchen, Germany, and was initially buried in the German cemetery. In 1946, they removed all the bodies and brought them into the different American cemeteries. Most people don't realize that there's actually 15 overseas cemeteries and about 178,000 graves. My Uncle Wright is buried at the Netherlands American Cemetery. So his letters home to my parents and to my other uncle, a story started rolling around in my head, not really his story, but a B-17 story.
Your book, Not Just Another War Story, is a loving tribute to your uncle, and not just to your uncle, but to all of the B-17 pilots.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is not only the pilots, but people don't realize that the 8th Air Force alone, which flew out of England, had more individuals killed than the Marine Corps did during the entire war. And as I say, most all those are buried in cemeteries in France, Belgium, the Netherlands, England. And so I started to put together a story, quite frankly, with the characters that I had. I had the lead character, Steve Carmichael, and he and his dad have a cattle ranch. He graduates from the University of Florida in May of 1942. His dad purchased an old World War I biplane that was used for airmail. And his dad bought it for less than $100. And somebody had said to him, "What the devil do you want with an airplane?" He said, "Well, maybe I'll get somebody to teach Stevie and I to fly the darn thing," which is the basis of the story that Steve Carmichael had actually been flying since he was 11 years old, soloed at 12. So that by the time that he graduated from the University of Florida, there was only one thing that he wanted to do, and that was to fly the four-engine B-17 Flying Fortress.
B-17, one of the greatest planes ever. I love that plane.
Yeah, it truly is. I've actually flown in four different ones with crews, and it's an absolute thrill. I always take up the position of the engineer, which is right behind the pilot and co-pilots. They say, "Oh, you can see views from different places." I said, "No, I want to be right here in the cockpit, and I want to be." I flew as a private pilot, but to fly in a 17 is an absolute thrill.
The flights that you write about in the book are based on real flights. I mean, they are so exciting and gripping. I mean, you really have captured the essence of it. And it's
in the book, Not Just Another War Story, every single place in the book is real and you can go there. Every single aircraft, B-17, is absolutely correct right down to the serial numbers. And every bombing mission flew, when they flew a bombing mission, because obviously they spent time in London and different things like that as well, but every single bombing mission was an authentic 305th Bomb Group mission right down to the weather. So every single mission flown was an actual mission.
Well, it reads that way because it is very exciting and very compelling. Tell us more about some of the things that Steve did.
Well, the interesting thing was when he went to flight school, I wanted to bring my Uncle Wright into the book, and also I wanted to have the final mission and have Steve be with the 305th and 366th Squadron so that it was honoring my uncle all the way through. You go through single engine school and then over to multi-engine school and then finally to what they call four engine school.
So how long did that process take?
From the time that they start until they finish, probably very close to a year. And then he picks up the rest of his crew, who is the rest of his crew have also been training, and then you pick up your crew. Now, B-17, if you folks out there aren't quite familiar with it, up forward in the front of the B-17, in the left seat, you have the pilot, the right seat, you have the co-pilot, and then down in that plexiglass nose, you have the bombardier and the navigator. Now, those four are officers. And then standing behind the pilot and the co-pilot is the engineer, who is also the top turret gunner. And then if you walk backwards, going to the back of the plane, you walk through the bomb bay in a little catwalk that goes over there. And then there's the radio man, who is right behind that. And then you have the ball turret gunner, the two waist gunners, and then around behind the tail wheel, you have the tail gunner, so you have a 10-man crew. And one of the interesting things about that is that if you flew in a bomber crew and you were flying in the 8th Air Force, everybody who flew was a sergeant, except for, obviously, the four officers. And the reason for that was, in the very beginning of the war, if there was, say, a waist gunner who was a private first class or a corporal, they were treated very harshly by the Germans if they were shot down. And the sergeants were treated much better. So if you flew in a bomb crew, you were automatically a sergeant. And in the book, I have one young fellow who graduated from high school, and he was top of his class, so he was thrilled to be a private first class. And then they put him in a crew, and he says, I made sergeant. Isn't this terrific?
That's one story I didn't know until I read the book. You know, it's unbelievable how young these guys were when you look back and you read about how they were so young.
Yes. Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, toward the end of the war, late 44 and 45, you had 20-year-old fellows that were pilots of these B-17s flying them over there. In the beginning of the war, most of the fellows, beginning of the war from the United States aspect, after Pearl Harbor, and in fact, the first bombing mission really took place on the 4th of July of 1942 from the American viewpoint. But you had more, a little bit older and more experienced pilots, and most of those fellows at that time were like 23, 24 years old. And some of them who had been career and wanted to get into a crew were actually a little bit 27, 28 years old. So you did have some older fellows in there. But as, like you were saying, as the war went on, you had these kids coming out, graduating high school, and 8 months later, they're in a B-17 crew flying over there, you know, and most of them scared to death. You know, they think it's a great thrill, or thought it was a great thrill, until the first anti-aircraft shell flak came up and exploded near the aircraft, or if they had an ME-109 coming up and firing machine gun bullets, or the FW-190 fighter planes for the Germans firing at them. Because when they were in gunnery school, they were firing. They never had anybody firing back at them. So, you know, one of the interesting things was, in a flight crew, if you were flying that day, you got fresh eggs and bacon. Otherwise, they were, you know, everybody else had powdered eggs. Yeah. I've been a member of the 305th Bomb Group Memorial Association for the last 40 years on behalf of my Uncle Wright, and have gone to all of those reunions and talk with those heroes of long ago. And believe me, anybody who has been into service to me is an absolute hero. And listening to the stories of those older gentlemen now as they get together. And that also gave me an awful lot of inspiration in terms of being able to write and to include.
And you've captured the essence, the voice of the pilots. It's
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
it's very, very compelling. Let's get back a little bit to Steve Carmichael. What happens to him as he finishes flight school?
This whole book took 9 years of writing and research, as I like to say, to get it right. Because the one thing I wanted was if a B-17 pilot or a crew member, when they were reading the different parts on it, I wanted them to be able to curl up their legs, sit back, and then thoroughly enjoy that section rather than say, oh, he don't know what he's talking about.
The authenticity of it
is extremely, every single detail. Even I've had pilots tell me, Wayne, that's exactly how I did the startup on the engines. You caught everything. Steve goes on and he picks up his crew. After he has his crew, he actually comes to MacDill Air Force Base, and that's where they would do what they call finishing school, and they were using Egmont Key and Old Fort DeSoto as bombing ranges.
Which is funny, because just recently they detonated a bomb out here by Fort DeSoto, which was one of the bombs Steve probably dropped.
They found some that were there, yeah. And then they would fly from there up to Bangor, Maine, and then from Bangor, Maine to go overseas. And I put myself in the book, in which when they were flying up, and Uncle Wright Ellis Gerke, when they were flying up toward Bangor, Maine, Tommy Reed, who was the co-pilot, was from Pottsville, Pennsylvania, Uncle Wright from the Philadelphia, Camden area. And the navigator, Joe Costa, he was from New York, but his wife was living with my Uncle Wright's wife in Merchantville, New Jersey. So they decided to foul up one of the engines on purpose and then radioed ahead and said, oh, we're having difficulty with the engines and we're going to have to land in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And then they landed at Allentown, made phone calls, and four carloads of family quickly drove up the 60 miles to Allentown to visit with them. And as I put in the book, and his nephew, godson, Wayne, got to sit in his pilot seat.
Oh, that's cute.
And then from there, they fly up to Bangor, Maine. And
that's the fun of being a writer. You can put yourself into seats sometimes.
Yeah. And then they flew from Bangor, Maine, and then from Bangor, Maine, they go over to, with a brand spanking new B-17, you fly over to Prestwick, Scotland, and then they take the plane away from you. And you're assigned, at that time, you go down to what is called Bevington, so that you can spend about 2 weeks there in England, so that you can learn the English way of air traffic, because there can only be one way. And they needed to fly the British way in terms of flying in and out of airports, airspace, things like that, so that there were not any collisions. And when you were assigned to a group and then a squadron, you then got to fly whatever they assigned to you, which would usually be a plane that had a little bit of mileage on her, a number of missions.
Steve's first mission?
They first flew some practice missions, and then they flew the first missions that went up into Kassel, Germany.
I don't want to give away the ending to this exciting book, but I would like you just to tell us a little bit more about Steve Carmichael. How many missions did he go on?
Steve, when he was over there, he actually, at the time that he went over there, which was May of 1943, he actually went May 17th, 1943, that he arrived in England. And interestingly enough, the prior 25 and back home missions now became 30 missions after those who arrived in May of 1943. The reasons was very simple. They were losing so many air crews and replacements were not coming. Later on, quite frankly, they had to fly 35 missions. But when Steve was over there, they had to fly 30 missions. On his 24th mission, he flew 24 missions, very exciting missions. I reread them myself. He is then, he's at this point, he was a second lieutenant, promoted to first lieutenant, and then after the 24th, he was promoted to captain and was transferred to a Pathfinder group away from his own crew. And Howie, who was his co-pilot, took over the crew of the aircraft called Pappy's Pack. And again, right down to the serial numbers, a real aircraft. The Pathfinder B-17 was one that had radar under the nose. And what was occurring was, one, obviously the weather oftentimes was not very good. So therefore, it might be cloud cover. Then they had to fly to a second target or a target of opportunity. With the Pathfinder could not only see through the smoke screens that the Germans also put up, but likewise could peer through the clouds and could also distinguish between water and land, because the submarine pens, for example, might be up a river, and there might be homes and different things around that, so that in order to concentrate on that particular, the Pathfinder then would drop its bombs or would fire a flare, and then the rest of the aircraft would drop their bombs on the Pathfinder. So Steve is put into a Pathfinder group because they needed pilots, and he was an experienced pilot. The particular mission that he was on in his as a Pathfinder pilot, his plane, it takes a direct hit from flak, blew about a 4-foot hole in the right wing. The two engines became engulfed in flame because they hit the fuel tanks as well.
Oh, hello. Yes. Okay. All right. I was just thinking about something really important here. The 7th anniversary of Joy on Paper is coming up, as I mentioned, and Tasha Alexander and Drew, I call him Drew, but Andrew Grant are going to be my guest host with me, and we are going to announce on that day, we are going to announce the 5 winners of the Patsy Award. When I was just looking at the list, it is really quite exciting. Over the years, I've been thinking more and more about what I can do to help authors really get noticed, because this is so important. As I mentioned, it's so difficult for authors to get noticed after they've published a book. And unless they continue, and they have to continue always building their platform and working harder to get noticed. But I thought I would give this Patsy Award. Each year I'm going to give, I don't know how many, but this year, for the first one, I'm going to give 5 Patsy Awards. And these are to, I haven't, because of the COVID and all of this pandemic-y stuff, I haven't been able to form a committee so that we can do it all together once a year and select the winners. These are based primarily on the responses I've had from listeners to an interview. When I've given had an interview, and then when I always know if people really, really love the interviews, is when I get home, if there are emails already waiting for me and saying, oh, that book sounds interesting, I'd like to read it, or can you tell me more about this book? And this is what is so wonderful, that so many of the authors that you listen to on Joy on Paper have inspired you. Like, for example, just now, Wayne McDowell. Wayne McDowell is an example of what you can do. If everybody has somebody in their family who has done something interesting. And in Wayne's case, it was his uncle who was a B-17 pilot. And he wrote letters home. And after years of research and a great deal of research, he traveled in Europe. He went to the cemeteries. He followed all sorts of just different paths to do the research. And I can tell you one thing, it's wonderful to do the writing and have the book published, but those years, sometimes years that you're doing research, are so enriching, because as you're doing the research, you're going out and you're meeting people, you're talking to people. Writing a book does so many good things for you. Your mind expands, your vision expands, your whole world expands, and you meet so many wonderful people. It is great to do research. I mentioned Tasha Alexander. Tasha Alexander did research. She went to the British Museum Library. And when you're writing a book where you're going to mention a place, those places will just open the doors for you. They love to welcome you. And so she got the wonderful tour of the entire basement. It's enormous, of the British Museum Library, which I was lucky enough to have because I used to do my research at the British Museum Library. But whatever you're writing a book about, whatever, you know, you find something, it could be military, it could be historical, it could be, and you will find that you will be welcomed. And also, if you're doing research like into a book about crime, you contact your local police, you contact detectives, and your world expands. It's really exciting. I think that's one of the greatest things about writing is that research part where you're, you know, no matter what, you know, sometimes you can't write every morning or every evening or whatever your time schedule is, but you can do that research, reading a book about a subject. For example, I'm talking about military history in the case of this wonderful book by Wayne McDowell, Not Just Another War Story. He did so much research into World War II European history of the period and also of the airplanes. And I know I'm doing a book about India set in the 1875, and I'm doing so much research. So it's just so exciting. And I think it's so important. You need something to keep your mind occupied. And as all of the authors, like Jojo Moy said, her character is there. It's not really a character anymore. It's a friend. And that's why her books, the trilogy that she's written, by the way, the reason I wanted to talk to her is the 10th anniversary of Me Before You, and there's a special edition. Go to her website, Jojo Moyes, Jojo Moyes, and there's a new edition coming out of her first book in the trilogy because it's the 10th anniversary. And this is what's so exciting. You have all these things that you can do, all these wonderful ways to expand your mind, to make your life interesting, to just be able to be interesting to your family and friends, because they also, I'm sure Wayne had to interview all of his family members, everything he could find out about his uncle, and it opens so many areas of conversation for you. So I hope that all of you will really think about and be inspired by Jojo Moyes. Look, she wrote a book. You know, it went crazy and 65 weeks on the best-selling list. It doesn't happen to everybody. Everybody's not going to get a movie. Wayne McDowell, actually, this would make a wonderful film. I would, if I had the influence to influence people in Hollywood, I would tell them, just option this, because it would be such an exciting book. The Audible version is fantastic. So you can get that, and I know that, I think right now they have a special promo if you sign up for a free trial, that you can get an Audible book free. Anyway, it's a wonderful thing. Because, you know, you have to remember what I always tell you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an Audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for both of Carol J. Perry's cozy mystery series. Particularly, I'd love to do the Haunted Haven one, because they'd film it maybe right here in our neighborhood, and we would get to see it. That would be exciting. say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. He keeps me going. He keeps me all organized. Anyway, everybody, thank you so much, and have a wonderful day. We're going to have 87 degrees. Oh, it's so fantastic. Bye-bye now.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
WZHR, Zephyr Hills.
FM 104.3.
Listen.
It's time for the Tuesday edition of Canada Calling, the news from home for vacationing Canadians. A presentation of Publix, where shopping is a pleasure. This is Pryor Smith speaking from Toronto. Thanks for joining us. In the House of Commons last evening, the Trudeau government, propped up, they say reluctantly, by the New Democrats, managed to gain approval of its implementation last week of the Federal Emergencies Act. This act will be in place temporarily, and the NDP says it'll pull its support when it feels the emergency period brought on by the blockades and protests of recent weeks has passed. That period of time being talked about is 30 days. Outside the Parliament buildings in downtown Ottawa, the streets have been cleared after 3 weeks of blockades.